Well, go ahead and get your Bible and turn to Acts. Acts chapter 19, I think it is. 19. We're going to finish chapter 19 tonight. And, you know, sometimes in the scriptures you come to a passage where the primary characters in the text are not believers. And it's kind of weird when you come to a text like that because you kind of go, okay, we got a group of guys who don't know the Lord and they are like the primary characters in the story for like 30-something verses here. It's kind of weird when you think about it. You go, why would God inspire Luke to write this story and include it in the book of Acts about people who don't know the Lord? And there's a point. We're going to get to that. Last we met was 2 weeks ago, because last weekend was Fifth Sunday, and we talked about that little story about how the sons of Sceva had tried to invoke the name of Jesus with that great little statement, I adjure you by the Jesus whom Paul proclaims. And if you remember, their attempt at that failed miserably. They got attacked by a man who had a demon. They got beaten. They got run out of the room, as we'd say around here, buck naked. And it didn't go well for these guys. But God was surely moving in Ephesus. And as we looked at that last text, we discovered in that kind of obscure ending of that text that there was a lot going on there, and there was probably a lot of church planting going on and a lot of gospel sharing going on and a lot of people getting saved going on, which is a really thing that you want to see going on. That's a good thing, okay? And with those things going on, the culture of the region is beginning to change. As the gospel is lifted, people begin to hear the gospel, they begin to commit their lives to Christ. And I don't know if you've noticed, but when you commit your life to Christ, generally other things begin to change. Your financial emphases begin to change. Your time emphases begin to change. The things that are in your mind, your thoughts begin to change. That's what's going on here in Ephesus. I've entitled the message, Riot at Ephesus. I thought later in the week, I said, you know, I could have entitled this The Power of One. And you'll see why as we work through the text, is there's two individuals who by themselves stir up or steer a population in a direction that is kind of interesting. And so a couple of thoughts. Well, let's begin with the first part of it, because it's one of those pivotal moments in the book, because what's getting ready to happen is Paul is getting ready to shift. And what happens from this point pretty much to chapter 28, however long it takes us to get there, which will probably be a while, is Paul's focus is first to go to Jerusalem and then ultimately to Rome. And that's how the book's going to end. So this is a big shift. And then we're going to see what's going on in town around all these things. So look at verse 21. Paul plans to move on. That's where I've entitled this part of the text. Now, after these events, Paul resolved in the spirit to pass where? Through Macedonia and Achaia and go to Jerusalem, saying, after I have been there, I must also see Rome. And having sent into Macedonia two of his helpers, a guy named Timothy and a guy named Erastus, he stayed himself stayed in Asia for a while. Now, after the events we looked at 2 weeks ago, what we've got a sense here that Paul is going, okay, God's been doing some amazing things here. The gospel is sharing here. The churches are getting established here. Therefore, my time here is coming to a close. Now you go, well, why didn't Paul just like stay? Why didn't he stay there and spend the rest of his ministry? That wasn't Paul's calling. Paul's calling was not to be a pastor in the sense of a guy like me or a Ken Cox or a Frank Brooks or a brother Jim Moore back at my hometown. His call was not to be a pastor. His call was to be a church planter, to share the gospel. In fact, one of the things he really felt called to was the idea of sharing the gospel where no one had ever preached the gospel before. That was really his heartbeat. So for him to stay almost 3 years in Ephesus was like an eternity for this guy. If you've been following through, he never stays anywhere long. This is one of the longest places he ever stays. And his call didn't include him staying in Ephesus. So he senses the Holy Spirit beginning to speak to him, to not put down roots, to not stay in this place. I don't think he was against a calling from God to do that if it was God's call, but that didn't seem to be his call. He's been here about 3 years. Churches are being planted. Church leaders are being raised up. Local congregations are being pastored in the sense that they have people who are speaking to them and leading them and helping them to be the church within their communities. And so he says, I'm going to move on. Now you look at this and you go, okay, he's going to go to Jerusalem. So I guess Macedonia and Achaia must be on the way. They're not. That's what's really weird about this. What he does is he's on the southwest coast of modern Asia Minor. We have a map of that area, I think we do. And he is in this community of Ephesus, which is a big port city. It's down there in the southwest corner near Caria, C-A-R-I-A. And what he's going to do is he's going to take off and go to Jerusalem, which is over to the right end of that map. Sorry, I always do it this way, and y'all are on the backside. So he's heading over that way. So where's he going? Well, he's going to go west to go east. Well, that's logical, right? He's going to go back and visit the churches over in the area. What seems to have been going on in this area and at this time is that there is a collection being raised for the believers down at Jerusalem, and Paul is sending Timothy and Erastus, and he's going to go himself to pick up and to gather this offering. It's referred to in some other texts, and he's going to take it to Jerusalem when he goes. That's his plan, to go that way. And so he says, I'm not needed here in Ephesus. These churches in this region of Asia, you know, the Philadelphia, the Pergamum, the Thyatira, these churches are being established, so I'm going to move on and head out. So before he does, he sends Timothy and Erastus. Timothy, of course, is his son in the ministry. Erastus is mentioned in Romans 16. We'll get to him on a Wednesday night in the spring, but he's headed west. Paul's going to go with him, but now things blow up. Paul's out the door when all this happens, which is kind of interesting to me. Look at verse 23. About that time, there arose no little disturbance concerning the way. For a man named Demetrius, a silversmith who made silver shrines of Artemis, brought no little business to the craftsmen. These he gathered together with the workmen in similar trades and said, men, you know that from this business we have our wealth. And you see and hear that not only here in Ephesus, but in almost all of Asia, this Paul has persuaded and turned away a great many people, saying that gods made with hands are not gods. And there is danger not only that this trade of ours may come into disrepute, but also that the temple of the great goddess Artemis may be counted as nothing, and that she may be deposed from her magnificence, she whom all Asia and the world worship. Now, here's what's going on. You got one guy, this is the power of one guy stepping into a moment and sharing his thought, which is mixed with some truth and some not so much truth, and he comes up with a story. And here's what's going on. In any culture that has been pagan, where the gospel comes in, does everyone get saved? We want everyone saved. That's not the point. Does everyone get saved? They don't. And what happens in a situation like that is you end up with people who find their lives being pressed by the gospel, even though they're not accepting it themselves. And that's the situation for poor Demetrius. Here's a guy who was either a leader in the guild or at least a worker in the guild who, kind of get the visual, remember the shrine of Artemis was located in Ephesus. This was one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. Have you ever traveled to places that have got these really amazing sites? What do you always find alongside? Souvenir shops. This is an ancient souvenir shop to stop by and get your silver replica of the Temple of Artemis to take home to your friends and loved ones. Now, we chuckle, but how many of us have bought, not the Temple of Artemis, but something else like that? Can you imagine if your goddess is no longer being worshipped by as many people, how the business might suffer? So catch the first issue he brings up. His first big issue is this. Our business is going to drop off, guys. In fact, I would suspect it's already dropping off for them as people are coming to know Christ and their hearts are changing, their emphasis are changing. We've already seen they took and burned a bunch of the old books of witchcraft just recently in the text. So this is not that surprising. So here he is. He's upset. His paycheck's starting to decline. Have you ever gotten upset when your paycheck declines? Of course. That's normal, okay? But he goes on. He doesn't just stop there. He proceeds from the financial reason to a sense of community pride. He says, You all know that our city Ephesus is valuable and respected and important. And if this gets any further down the road, we're going to find that we're not as important any longer, because their importance was based on the Temple of Artemis being in the middle of the city. So as it begins to decline, and then he adds a shot of fear-mongering, and he says, and furthermore, she may even be deposed from her magnificence, the goddess Artemis may be, because of the work of this Paul and the people who follow the way. By the way, that's us, okay? That's another description for followers of Christ, followers of the way, ones who follow Jesus. And so he's spreading rumors and half-truths, the power of one. You know, really, it takes one person to stir up a crowd and whip up a frenzy if he knows how to do it. And that's what happens. Let's look here at number three. So when people hear rumors, what do? Sometimes they act on them. When they heard this, they said, oh, Demetrius, you're nuts. That'll never happen. It's not what happened. When they heard this, they were enraged and crying out, great is Artemis of the Ephesians. We just sang a song, great is the Lord. Wasn't that greatest? What was the name of that song, the last one? Great are you, Lord. Thank you. But the line in it is, great are you, Lord. That song, okay? So they would have sung it, great are you, Artemis. You know, kind of weird, all right? That's their statement. And so the city was filled with confusion. We know who the author of confusion is. And they rushed together into the theater, dragging with them Gaius and Aristarchus, Macedonians who were Paul's companions in travel. But when Paul wished to go in among the crowd, the disciples wouldn't let him. And even some of the Asiarchs, and those are high-ranking and local officials who were friends of his, sent to him and urged him not to venture into the theater. I've lost my place. Now, some cried out one thing, some another, for the assembly was in confusion, and most of them did not know why they had come together. Some of the crowd prompted Alexander, whom the Jews had put forward, and Alexander, motioning with his hand, wanted to make a defense to the crowd, but when they recognized he was a Jew, for about 2 hours, they all cried with one voice, great is Artemis of the Ephesians. You know, here's the strange thing about people who start rumors and try to spin stories to benefit themselves. A lot of people actually believe the stories. How many of you have ever read a post on Facebook and said, well, it must be true. It's posted, right? We have to be careful, don't we, what we hear. Even if they were filled with half-truths or outright lies, honestly, it really is too much work to seek out the real story, isn't it? Let's just take it as it is and run with it. Because that's a whole lot easier than going and doing some research and figuring it out, trying to find out what's really going on. That's what happened in Ephesus as a direct result of the one, Demetrius. The whole community becomes an uproar. The whole city gets turned on its end. And starting with the guild, they begin to shout, great is the false goddess Artemis, with their words creating a ruckus across the city as people began to get pieces of the story, began to join the crowd, began to add to the story and add those thoughts. And so with the city in an uproar, two of Paul's traveling companions from Macedonia, which is Greece, were dragged into the theater. That would have been a common sight in Greco-Roman cities. And things was about to get ugly, okay? It was about to get bad. And Paul says, I'll go in there. Thankfully, some of his disciples said, you lost your ever-loving mind, brother. You ain't going in there. And they stopped him. I paraphrase a little bit, okay? They stop him and say, don't go in there. And then even the local officials with whom Paul has built a relationship, at least, the Asiarchs, they look at him and say, don't. And there's no evidence, by the way, that those men were followers of Christ. They weren't Jesus' followers. They were just people in the community. And at this point, the crowd's out of control. They're seeking vengeance on somebody. Why? They're in a mob mentality. It's gone crazy. And in the midst of this melee, here's what happens. This poor guy named Alexander, who's a Jew, they go, hey, Alexander, you get up there and tell them we're not part of this. Remember, Christianity and Judaism overlapped a lot in the early days. And they wanted to make it very clear. Because, you know, we'd already seen two messages back, a conflict between the Jews and followers of the way. Y'all with me? They said, we got nothing to do with this. We've washed our hands of those people. And they don't want to hear that. And the place explodes with the thoughts and the shouting and the cry. Can you imagine a two-hour chant? Great is Artemis of the Ephesians. That's hard for us to even imagine in our day, isn't it? I mean, we get to noon and people are heading the door ready to go home. You know, we couldn't go 2 hours around here if we had to, you know? But that's the thought that's going on here. This is amazing, okay? So this goes on for 2 hours, and all of this because one man has whipped the crowd into a frenzy. The power of one. Then there's another guy, another one, another lost man who steps into the moment. Look at the next text here, verse 35. And when the town clerk had quieted the crowd, here's the one. He said, men of Ephesus, who is there who doesn't know that the city of Ephesians, of the Ephesians, is temple keeper of the great Artemis and of the sacred stone that fell from the sky? Most archaeologists believe that's a meteorite, probably. Seeing then that these things cannot be denied, you ought to be quiet and do nothing rash, for you have brought these men who are neither sacrilegious nor blasphemers of our goddess. If therefore Demetrius and the craftsmen with him have a complaint against anyone, the courts are open and there are proconsuls. Let them bring charges against one another. But if you seek anything further, it shall be settled in the regular assembly. For we really are in danger of being charged with rioting today, since there's no cause that we can give to justify this commotion. And when he said these things, he dismissed the assembly. The power of one. If you were a follower of the way at this point and you hear this commotion down at the theater for 2 hours, you might want to pack your bags and hit the door, right? We're out of here, baby. We might get killed if we stay around this place. But into this melee comes a man who's likely a pagan, who is definitely the town clerk, a respected member of the community, steps into the moment. Notice he didn't stop the crowd while they were in their height of frenzy. He let them go for two hours before he steps in and says, stop. Apparently he was respected. Or they were so hoarse they couldn't talk any longer. I don't know which one. But they stop. And he reminds the crowd of the commonly known importance of the Temple of Artemis. And we struggle with understanding the importance of that, but it would be kind of like to a Catholic, the Vatican today. There's not another one. It's very important to them. To the Temple Mount, to the Jews today, there's only one. Very important to them. That's the thought for these people. And you're going, but that's a pagan god. Why would people do that? People do it all the time. And he points out that the two men, Gaius and Aristarchus, were neither sacrilegious nor were they blaspheming the goddess, but they seem to be upstanding citizens in the temple, in the empire. And so if Demetrius has a problem, he needs to take it to the normal courts, the normal places, the places that we deal with these kind of issues, because we're in danger of rioting. And you're going, well, why would he care about that? Well, I think he cared about the population, one, but that's not the important thing. The important thing was this. They lived as Asian citizens under the Roman domination, and the Romans loved one thing above all else, peace. As long as you don't stir up trouble, we won't stir up trouble for you. That's what got the Jews in trouble in 70 AD. They finally stirred up so much trouble, the Romans said, fine, we'll just level the city. That'll fix the problem. And so what he's telling them is if we're not careful, we will put ourselves in a place of opposition to the Romans. And if they come down on us, Artemis help us, as he would have said it. We're in trouble. Our goddess wouldn't be able to save us then. So stop. And the crowd goes home. Now, what do we do with this? You know, when you look at a text like this in the Bible, you go, why would he put it in the text? Why would he include this? Well, I struggled with that this week, and I got to thinking about it. And there's some universal truths I think we could probably apply here. So let me give you just three thoughts. I guarantee you they're not all the things you could pull from this text, and they may not even be the best things you could pull from this text. They're just what I happen to be inspired to share with you tonight. Here they are. Number one, money often triumphs religion. The motivation behind Demetrius, I don't care what he said about, you know, the great goddess Artemis being thrown down and her reputation being sullied and all that stuff. His primary motivation was his paycheck. He was concerned about his living. Don't we all, right? It's just something that's common among all of us. What Demetrius was facing was a fundamental question in the lives of so many people. How do I make my ends meet? Maybe even more foundational question in this situation is this, though he probably didn't think about it this way, is this: what captures my primary allegiance in life? You see, every one of us has something or someone to whom we pledge our allegiance. Every one of us. Every one of us. Now, as a child of Christ, or of God, we're supposed to have our allegiance to who? To Christ, of course. You know, that's the Sunday school answer, right? But not everyone does in the world, and maybe not everyone does even in organized churches sometimes, but that's another discussion another day. But there's a decision that has to be made by every person on planet Earth, and it's this: will I seek financial stability or will I seek spiritual peace? Which comes first? Jesus put it this way: no man, no one can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money. You can't. At the heart of the Ephesian conflict was a loss of financial stability because of the gospel. Let that sink in. As the gospel was shared, more and more people come to know Christ. Individuals turn away from Artemis to Jesus. You don't need the objects of pagan worship if you're going to follow Jesus. What do you need to follow Jesus? A heart committed to Christ, right? A life committed to Jesus. That's what now poor Demetrius' business is under attack, is how he felt. You could say the real God Demetrius followed was financial stability. Just happened to call it Artemis. But isn't that stability really an illusion? Isn't that stability really something we can't truly capture in this life? One good stock market correction will tell you that, won't it? You know, we look at our retirement accounts and go, I think I'm getting, and then you realize maybe I'm not. Ultimately, those things are an illusion. Paul would talk about it this way over in Philippians: for I have learned in whatever situation I am in, I am to be content. I know how to be brought low and how to abound in any and every circumstance. I've learned the secret of facing plenty and hunger, abundance and need. And here it is: I can do all things through him who strengthens me. That's how I live my life. That's what Paul said to the Philippians. You and I have to be on constant guard to not let anything, money, fame, position, power, anything drag us away from having Christ as first. Let me rephrase that: as only in our lives. A second thought I kind of gathered from this is this: rumors tear apart community. Any of you ever played the old telephone game? I know some of the students in the room go, what? What's a telephone? You know, back in the old days, we had telephones that were on the wall or set on the desk, and it had a line that went into the wall. And those are antiques now. Many of us don't even have those in our houses anymore. And if you do, the only people who call are political figures wanting you to vote for them. Seems like, anyway. But you remember the game, telephone game. You tell one person a secret, and then they tell the secret, and they tell the secret, and they tell the secret, and it goes around a room, and you come back around, and the story has morphed, usually. That's rumors. That's rumors. There is something in all of us driving us to win at all costs. We want to look good. We want to sound good. We want to be perceived as something that maybe we're not. Even if it means we have to stretch the truth just a little, just an embellishment here or there, just to make the story a little juicier. Y'all with me? Can you imagine that day when the rumors started running through town, how things must have morphed to get the people whipped up into that kind of frenzy? The pagan religion of Artemis was not under serious threat yet from followers of the way. Would it? Absolutely. A couple hundred years later, it would be pushed aside as the official religion of Rome became Christianity. Wasn't there yet. But in this story, what we see is this: rumors started about the followers of the way, what they were doing and what it was about, and it literally was on the verge of tearing up community. And that's the principle I want you to see. Rumors tear apart community. When we buy into that game and play that game of sharing rumors, of repeating stories, of embellishing this a little bit along the way, what we do is tear up community. How many people's reputations have been sullied by the rumors spread by individuals? How many times have we participated in damaging the reputation of others when we've used words that were not quite accurate, or at least not quite confirmed? It's way easier to just repeat what we've heard as, no pun intended, gospel truth, than to find out the story ourselves. In fact, you know, often the lies are more juicy, aren't they? They're more enjoyable, aren't they? But they're much more devastating. And ultimately, I'm afraid they don't honor God. And they tear down community. May we be people who speak truth in love, but by all means, speak the truth, not rumor. One more thought I saw in this text that I thought was really kind of unusual, and this is probably what God was trying to teach me some this week. You know, sometimes we in the church, we get this perception that people in the world, pagans, don't have a clue what they're doing. They can't do anything right, can't do anything good. They don't know Jesus, so they must be nuts. Let me tell you, if they don't accept Christ, I think they're nuts, okay? I'm just going to tell you. It doesn't make any sense to me why a person would reject the offer of Christ for eternal salvation. I don't get that. I just don't know if I ever will. I don't know if I ever should, to be honest with you. But we sometimes, if we're not careful, we take that thought and carry it over and think, well, they can't come up with any good thoughts on their head in their head because they don't know Jesus. That's not true. We see in this story an illustration of a guy who was most likely lost, who led the town as a town clerk, who brought peace into a moment. And that brings me to this application. Wisdom can come from pagan people. Isn't that weird? When you think about it, you go, well, how could they do that? There's a nugget I want you to see here. Here's a guy, in all likelihood, popular pagan town clerk. He would have probably gone to the temple to worship Artemis on a regular basis. He had a place in the community that almost dictated he had to go to the temple to worship Artemis on a regular basis. He was a town leader. So here he is, pagan, through and through, working for the good of his community. But his words brought calm. His words brought peace. His thoughts brought about something good. And that may be startling to some of us, but here's the deal. Here's a man who stood diametrically, most likely diametrically opposed to the truth of the gospel, and yet he carried great wisdom. Wow. You know, we live in a day when people divide over a lot of stuff, don't we? We divide over just about anything. We'll get upset over something that somebody does. We allow ourselves to fracture over the differences we have instead of coming together on the things that unite us. I heard a preacher the other day on a radio, you may have heard this, speaking to his church, and especially to those of us 50 and older. Well, I got to tell you, that really hurt when I heard that, because I'm just barely over, but I'm over. That we're going to have to figure out, us senior adults are, our AARP members are. I didn't join yet, though I'm eligible. Figure out how to find common ground to work together. And here's why. It's not a matter of unity. It's probably a matter of survival. And here's why, this one guy said, and I agreed with him, is the generation in their 30s and under are looking at us. You know, I'm old enough to be a 30-year-old's dad. Too much reality tonight. They're looking at us and the way we sometimes behave in church, and they're saying, no, thank you. And that's not Baptist or Presbyterian or Methodist or non-denominational. That's church. So his point was, we need to get over it ourselves. Because this negativity and divisiveness that tends to divide, to define us, younger adults just want no part of. And they don't have to come. They got their own cars. Or at least the one daddy gave them. Those of us in the upper half of the demographic, unfortunately, have allowed negativity and divisiveness to define us so much that younger adults often don't want what we have. They say, no, thank you. Does that mean we shouldn't get involved in politics? Of course we should. Does that mean we shouldn't seek to change our culture? Of course we should. But we need to do it in a way, and this is a word for me I needed to hear this week, and I hope you do too, a way that is positive and encouraging is what we need to be doing. You know, one of the things I've been trying to do, especially on Sunday morning messages, is to look for the positive, look for the encouraging, look for the word that says, hey, this is what God can do with us if we let him. Because that's what younger ears, and I'm not preaching to tickle their ears, but we got to meet them where they are. We got to connect with them where they are. See, the Jesus of the Bible, the Jesus of the gospel, why did he come? To change lives for the better, not to take us into a battleground, not to take us into a fight, not to take us into an argument. This is what I wrote as I finished up. May we be a people who properly reflect the love, the grace, the mercy, and the dignity of the love of God that we profess to have within us. May we live up to the high calling of Christ. The conclusion is based on the broader text, and it's this. Conflict arises often whenever Jesus is not at the center. So where does Jesus need to be? In the center. Center of what? Center of your life and my life. Center of our church's life. The center of who we are. Father, I thank you for allowing us the privilege to come in here tonight and to sing and to worship and to fellowship and to hug each other's necks and to look at your word. And Father, I just pray that we'd be challenged by the power of one. And God, let us be the one individual who says, I'm going to be like the town clerk. Not a pagan and lost, but I'm going to be a child of God who steps up and speaks positive and speaks good and speaks truth in a loving way. Father, I pray for those in this room, Lord. Maybe there's someone who needs to make a decision. We want to give an opportunity to do that. But Father, we want to be people who are in the midst of your plan. In Jesus' name.